right, we'll get started. So, I am going to finish Pearl today. So, we will start with the Pearl 4 notes, and then we will do some of the Pearl 5 notes. So, we will skip some foils which describe the formatted I.O. in Pearl, because I have not found that myself very useful. The one thing I wanted to, which I mentioned to you lectures ago, is this variable dollar slash or dollar input underbar record underbar separator or dollar RS, which you can set to be the character that Pearl recognizes as the end of line. And it can be set to anything you like. It is defaulted to new line. So this allows you to scan lines for, you can read in, so when you read a line, it will read to the next occurrence of this character, which could be, for instance, a less than sign, which will then give you the next tag of an HTML in an HTML page. Or once you've started that, you can then scan to the next greater than sign, which gets you the end of the tag, whether or not there happened to be a new line. So this is very convenient in HTML, because in HTML page, a new line is largely irrelevant. And you're not terribly interested in where new lines occur. Everything is controlled by tags, which are controlled by these characters here, greater than and less than. The other stuff on this page is irrelevant, because it's concerned with this formatted I.O. All right, so this, you presumably are familiar with the star notation in Unix, which you use to match file names when you're invoking the shell, which is of course slightly different from the dot star notation in regular expressions. Almost the same, but not quite. So this is called globbing. Presumably globbing stands for globalizing. And so you can, in Perl, use the star notation, which is obviously useful if you're trying to find out if a particular type of file exists, the same reason you want to use it on the Unix command line. So you can use it inside the diamond operator, and it will behave just like you'd expect. It will return all files which are matched by the usual shell rules for processing star, and it just uses star as a wildcard. So if you're in a particular directory and you set an array equal to the diamond operator star CPS 616 star, close diamond operator, it will return in that array A all file names that have CPS 616 in it. So this is just, that's what you'd expect. It gives you the names of all files in the current directory which match according to the normal rules of the shell. And you can, of course, use absolute addresses or relative addresses. If you use an absolute address, then it will go to that absolute address. So it does what you'd expect, and it does variable interpolation, so you can use variables, like in this example here, dollar home. You can use dollar home as part of the string, and then you will, in that example here, at the bottom, dollar home slash star, if dollar home is your home address, it will match to it will give you a listing of all files in your home directory. So there is an example here. So here I have this string here is the one which it's going to be matched to, so it happens to be the directory with this Perl Virtual Programming Lab in it, and it's matching to any directory followed by *.pl. And if we the way it's designed, you can put in any string that, I mean, any legal directory there, because it will just, it's just going to use variable interpolation. So when we submit that, we find that this returned all the Perl programs, which, I mean, all the files that match that string. And so if we look at the program up here, hopefully we can see it doing its thing here. So dollar pattern is the thing we read in, and I just said glob dollar pattern. So it's very simple. Remember, I pointed out that in Perl, you're free to include the argument of a function either in brackets or not. So glob space dollar pattern is the same as glob open parentheses dollar pattern close parentheses. So the glob is the same as the diamond operator, the glob command. Next. All right, so these are relatively straightforward, although the open dir is a little confusing. So chdir, I mentioned last time, it does exactly the same as cd in Unix. It changes changes to the directory given by the argument. Makedir, mkdir does what you'd expect. You've got to specify the name of the directory you want to create and the mode. Opendir is a pretty useful command. It is what you use when you want to do some processing for all files in the directory. So opendir is like open, except instead of opening a file, it opens a directory. And once you've opened that directory, you can use readdir, and readdir basically, well, it can do various other things, but the most obvious thing it does is just return you a file name. And so it's like the diamond operator for reading a file that returns you successive lines, and then it returns you null. Readdir returns you successive files in the directory, and then when there's no more files, it returns you the null file. So there's meant to be an example of this. Alright, so here's a particular directory which we're going to supply, and it tells you all the files. So if we now look at this program, this coloring has actually got screwed up by Netscape. I should probably reload the frame. You see? Alright. So here I say opendir. This is the name of the handle, which I'm going to use in the later readdir command. $dir was that script, that was the pattern I read in the particular directory. Then I have a while loop which loops over the names and the files in the directory. Typically, it will return you the file dot and the file dot dot, which exists in every Unix directory. typically you don't want to do much with that, so you just say, do something like I have here where I say next if the name of the file is dot or dot dot, because I don't want to do anything. In this case here, I then just print out the name of the file. If you wanted to do some processing, like changing its name, this is a file, I often find I have a directory with all the files with the wrong name, but this is a very convenient, you can use this little Perl script to rename with suitable modifications. If you wanted to change the name of the file, you do some processing on $name to get your new name, and then you just do, you'd execute the Unix command move to move it from the old name to the new name. So there are all sorts of useful things you could do. Right, so that's that. So in my opinion, Perl is a lot easier to use than the Unix shell because the syntax is much cleaner. It's a programming language syntax, and it's got a much more powerful set of commands. So although you can do that type of, you can do a lot of that in principle with the Unix shell, Perl doesn't have a lot more overhead. The programs in Perl are almost the same length as the Unix shell, and in my opinion, a lot easier to understand. Well, so all this says here was something which you will, which is actually illustrated in every one of those Perl programs, that there is an associative array %env which holds the environment parameters of your Unix system. The reason why that's actually used by all the programs that process form data, because CGI scripts typically have their information passed to them in environment parameters, and so these library routines you call to process to give you the form data has to use this fact that Perl supplies you the server passes the results to the CGI script in the environment variable. That environment variable can just be accessed through this associative array, where the argument of the associative array is the name of the particular environment variable. Here it's path. And this little example here prints out the total environment because it just runs over the keys, which are the defined attributes in this associative array %env. Alright, so there are many different ways of executing Unix commands. The simplest is the back quote notation, which again was present in every single one of those Perl programs, because it's how I found the date. On the shell, back quote is often used to execute things. So in Perl, if you include a string in back quotes, it will just execute that as a Unix command. So if you wish to execute the Unix date command and have the result of the date command just return to you as a string to your Perl program, you just say back quote date quote, back quote. If you wish to try to remove all the world's files, you would do back quote rm star, back quote. So notice sort of how, this is relatively elegant. You have now a string called $now, then you have today's date, dotted, the concatenation operator, back quote, date, back quote, semicolon. So that's a very simple way of generating a string which says today's date is colon space followed by the date. And you have to be reasonably, you have to know a little bit about the Unix command. Date, it naturally returns a scalar. Who, which lists all the users logged in, naturally returns an array. And so you'd usually set, if you execute backslash quote, back quote who, back quote, you would usually set that to be an array. A that would be more natural. And so here's an example of the RM command, and so this one shows you how you can send the standard error to the same place as the standard output, so that you can get standard output returned to standard error returned to your Perl program. So this is a slightly peculiar syntax. So this is, if you like, the way that Perl does the Unix pipe command. So if you follow a Unix command by a vertical underbar, and then you use that in an open command. So remember, open usually has a Unix file name here. Let me just get this right. So this who is something which would typically give you an output. So instead of reading something from a file, you might wish to specify, instead of a file name with a less than file name, you do who vertical underbar, then you open that thing as though it was a file. That effectively sets up a pipe from the Unix command who to your program, which you then access in the same way as an ordinary file with a Darman operator. Then if you wish to print something, you are for the line printer, that's typically something where you pipe the results to a line printer. So you say vertical bar LPR to your favorite printer, and then you open a file handle with this pipe, output pipe as the argument. Then when you print there, and so there, instead of being a reading, you typically print. So you print to that file handle, and then it will go automatically piped to the line printer. So that's how you do pipes in Perl. So if you want to do complicated multiprocessing, you do fork and exec, but I don't think that's terribly important. And there's also not only an associative array for the environment, there's an associative array of for the signals. And it's a little subtle, the associative array for signals essentially gives you the event handler for that particular Unix signal. So all the Unix signals have names like interrupt, and say for some reason Perl usually Unix calls an interrupt something like sigint with SIG. The signal in front of it, Perl knows them as the name with SIG removed. So the associative array $sig with the name int, the value of that is the handler, which you can overwrite if you want to handle that particular interrupt. So you would have to be doing reasonably advanced processing for that to be relevant. And I skipped this file here for no reason. So this is pretty important. So the simplest way of accessing Unix commands from Perl is just a system command. So if you want to do if you want to run a general Unix command like copy or something more complicated than the simple things we've shown how to do so far, run a C program, C compiler. You just hand the Unix command you want to the Perl program system. The system followed by a string is just executed as a Unix shell. And that's pretty useful. And this set describes eval, and as I mentioned, Perl and JavaScript both have an eval command, and the reason why eval is useful is that eval takes its argument and runs the Perl interpreter on it, and so same for JavaScript. Eval in JavaScript runs the JavaScript interpreter on the argument, and so why is this useful? The reason it's useful is that you can then do one level, if you like, of indirection, because you can construct the command using Perl. So here is an example. Supposing I had a couple of arrays, $Fred and $Jim, which may be labeled the some properties of these people, Fred and Jim. And so I've worked out that I wish to store some information in Fred or Jim for a particular index value, and the information I want to store in the array is called $name. So I could do that by saying, if I want to store in Fred, $Fred equals something, or I want to store it, so I can do an if statement, and if otherwise store it in Jim. Alternatively, I can construct the name here. So the name, which is going to be Jim or Fred, then I construct the index with its open square brackets, $index, close square brackets, here's what I want to store, and then I hand this constructed thing to eval. Perl will first calculate this quantity, which it will then generate the required Perl line, and then it will evaluate it, it will hand it again to Perl. So it essentially applies Perl twice to this command. Now that's not so, a much safer and easier way to do this particular thing is to use something which we haven't formally described how to do, but is now added in Perl 5, which is to use an associative array. Because effectively associative arrays allow you to do the same thing, because you can have another name here, I've called it options, and as we will describe soon, you're allowed multi-dimensional arrays where one argument is the associative array, which is in curly brackets, which is this thing $name, and then there's this array index $index equals $value. So for this particular example of using eval, I could do exactly the same thing using a multi-dimensional associative array, which is a lot, I mean, I would view this as somewhat easier to read than this. This is not very intuitive, because there are a lot of quotes in this particular syntax. You could do it a little more elegantly with remembering you have to escape these square brackets because they're special meta characters, but still, this is not as easy, I think, as understandable as this syntax. But still, eval is quite useful at times. And in fact, eval is used in many of these example Perl programs, as I mentioned. So as you probably know, on Monday I was making remarks about how insecure this Perl program might be, and on Tuesday at 2 p.m. somebody from an unnamed university logged on to Nova and Spiker and executed RM star running as root on those two computers, bringing down MPAC. And so if any of you have lost files, we lost a lot of files because of that. And they were some of the course-related files were lost because of this particular person who decided it would be fun to try running RM star as root from these two machines. So actually those machines are not up and running yet because it takes about a day to bring, because we have to rebuild those machines totally from scratch because all the system programs were removed on those machines. So anyway, they did not actually run my Perl program, but they did manage to show the danger of people being able to get into a Unix system and execute commands that you shouldn't execute. So one thing I found out from that on talking to our systems people, it appears that there are so many bugs in Unix that it is impossible to stop that. There are dozens of bugs and dozens of, you know, many different operating systems, and try to fix all of them is impossible. So you have to live with this possibility of people deciding to delete all your files. So the moral is you better make certain that you have some backup, possibly. So it turns out the only files they deleted were files which were world readable and world writable, and were owned by root. So files owned by individuals were not deleted. So that's why there's not a total catastrophe. Right. So, by the way, next on Monday I intend to start VRML. So I'm going to do whatever I will get through on Perl 5 in the remaining 45 minutes. So this should be the file set you just got. And this book here I mentioned, this Camel book, is the only known book which describes Perl 5. Although the Llama book is meant to be out with a new edition in May. And presumably when the Llama book, which is a small book, comes out in the new edition, it will discuss Perl 5. Alright, so we've mentioned, I tried to update so what you saw in the lectures up to now, which were called Perl 4, were the features of Perl 4 with comments on Perl 5, where it modified those features in a dramatic fashion. So what you will discuss in the rest of the time is those features of Perl 5 which are new features and therefore would not have been discussed in the previous lectures. So some of these are critical and some of these are not so critical. So here's just a couple of foils which list these some of the new features or advances or what have you in Perl 5. I would say to me the most important thing that Perl 5 gives is multi-dimensional arrays. Perl 4 only has one-dimensional arrays. And those arrays can be arbitrary mixtures of lists, which are square brackets, or hashes, which are curly brackets. So you can have any number of square brackets and any number of curly brackets after your Perl name for general multidimensional names. There is a library structure which is defined by modules which end in .pm instead of .pl. There's clearly inferior to Java object-oriented structure. And it's inferior because Perl 4 was not object-oriented, and they had to add object orientation on in a way which preserved Perl 4, and therefore they compromised it somewhat. There's well-defined interfaces to C and C++, so that you can call C and C++ from Perl and vice versa. There's some ways which I don't think are going to be terribly important, which I don't think is that important, of giving general database interfaces called tie and untie. There's something called autoload, which I probably won't mention anymore, which allows you to specify an arbitrary action if a subroutine is called which is not defined, so that effectively allows you to define an event handler for undefined subroutines, and you can you can name subroutines before they're implemented with a subcommand. This is quite useful. I've already mentioned some of these. that there are three major regular expression enhancements, that now there's a way of distinguishing parentheses which specify references. These are the things that are $1 through $n, and just parentheses for using grouping. And you can also tell Perl to use either minimal or maximal matching, and also you can add comments in regular expressions. There's an extremely ingenious use of pointers in Perl, which makes it look like C and C++. There are a bunch of new routines, and there are a set of so-called pragmas which allow you to specify in more detail how the interpreter works. Well, here's a brilliant invention. Instead of writing, whenever you write comma, you can write equal greater than. So this is what you always wanted to do. And so it's not as silly as it seems, because you may remember that the way we specified our hashes was by defining a list which was twice as long as the hash, then every odd entry in the list was a key, and every even entry was a value, and we separated them by commas. But ingeniously now we take every odd numbered comma and replace it by equal greater than, and it now looks as though we have a new syntax for specifying hashes as key equal greater than value, comma, key equal greater than value. But really all Perl has done is allow you to use equal greater than instead of comma. So it doesn't actually think it's any change, but it suddenly looks different. Okay. So there's a dash greater than operator, which is a truly new operator. So it's the one that converts references to values. And it's also used in the... So it also is used in where you would use the dot notation in Java for, say, attaching a method to an object, you would use dash greater than. So dash greater than is sort of the heart of a lot of the object-oriented and pointer features in Perl. I already mentioned that quotes are now optional where they're not necessary. So in hashes, you do not need quotes around the arguments of a hash. So Perl allows a thing called, as in Java, you can collect bunches of Perl programs together and call them a package, and you do that by saying package followed by the name of the package, and then you you use two, this is I guess like C++, you use two colons to tell to specify variables in a package. So if I wish to reference a variable in package Fred, I need a dollar because it's a variable. So dollar var, you see, is in package Fred. I'd access as Fred colon colon var. Now if inside package Fred we defined another package called Jim, we would use Fred colon colon Jim colon colon var, and so on. So modules are the same thing as packages, but they're essentially used as libraries. And to tell Perl it's a library, you call it not .pl, you call it .pm. And of course, the feature of a library is you only load the parts of it you need. So we'll take an example of a package which happens to be from the standard Perl library for processing the web called LWP. library for web processing. It has a package called HTML format PS, which has all the routines needed to convert HTML to PostScript. And so this is defined by a file called formatps.pm in a directory called HTML. Alright. So that's sort of a little like, alright, so actually what I have here, hopefully, yes. So the next file or two, talks a little bit about this particular file, because I just chose this as a typical file which illustrates the module and package features of Perl. So if you wish to use Perl a lot for processing the web, as far as I know, this particular library called LWP is the best thing to use. About half of this book, or maybe essentially all of this book called Web Client Programming, is devoted to teaching you how to use that particular library. So it's called Web Client Programming with Perl. It's from O'Reilly. And O'Reilly presumably is going to be the dominant vendor supporting Perl, because I mentioned that Larry Wall, who writes this book, has just been hired by O'Reilly. He used to be at JPL, then he went to another company. Now he works for O'Reilly. O'Reilly's going to come up with a supported version of Perl, so I assume that Perl will effectively be owned by O'Reilly as a supporter of it. So this particular... So if you wish to use this software can be downloaded from the Master Perl Archive. This book here, or lots of places, will tell you where the Master Perl Archive is. We should probably put a pointer to the Perl Archive on our webpage. And it's got a whole bunch of Perl libraries there, including one for the web, and it's trivial to download. We can even put a point. If I downloaded that particular library, we can just put a pointer to the library as well. Alright. Anyway, this is a reasonably... I would view this at least as well written. It's relatively easy to read, this particular code. And so as an example of how to write object-oriented Perl, I would view this as a pretty good example. So there's not much point in reading this file, because this file says exactly what that program does, because it's just a copy of that program. And the only thing that this file pointed out that there's these peculiar things with equal signs in column 1. So I do not recommend learning about things with equal signs in column 1. They are Perl's way of including documentation with the Perl program. So anything after those equal signs, it actually generates documentation. It doesn't generate Perl code. There's a syntax in Java that does the same, that allows you to specify embedded documentation, but so it's again a different syntax. So this is called the Perl pod notation. And we may be able to... Alright, so that's what that does. So this is just examples which I'll actually of this pod syntax, and it's defining this module, and this gives you illustrations of the object-oriented syntax in Perl, which has a new command like Java. As we'll see, one of the confusions in Perl, the new is not a language, it's actually a subroutine name. If there's any reason you're going to use new, is that you've ingeniously made the constructor for this class, you've called it new. And so, Perl, as I say, why Perl's object-oriented syntax is a little peculiar, because it's sort of constructed by hand to look like other languages, but actually it's not. So that's, alright, so this file here just makes a few remarks about this pod notation, so that equal H1 effectively is equivalent to the heading H1, and equal to H2 is effectively equivalent to H2, and equal item, which you'll see, is effectively equivalent to a bulleted list, and so on. And then the end of this documentation is equals cut, and so on. So the only reason to know that is to know what to skip when you're reading that Perl program, so that you know when you're reading pod and when you're reading Perl. Otherwise it's a little confusing. So Perl has many ways of reading in files as libraries, and there's use and require. Use and require are effectively, are qualitatively the same, and there's slight differences. Use is done for modules, and it actually is the most powerful, because when you invoke use, then all the functions inside that module are available for calling without putting the module name in front of them. If you use require, you're allowed to access that module, but you must use the name of the module :: when accessing the variable. Require can also be used to load Perl programs which are not in module form, and that's actually the simplest way of having a simple library of Perl programs, is to stick them in a file with a .pl and then just say require of that file. You again find that all those CGI programs in the Perl VPL have a require command at the front, because they're just which is just telling Perl, go and read that file and import all the and include all the functions you see in that file. All right, so that's the end of the discussions of packages and modules and use and require. And so we should spend a little bit of time on references. And so there are two types of references, so-called hard and soft references. So the great power of Perl, and also its great tragedy, is that you have to understand exactly how an interpreter works in order to use Perl. So the way an interpreter works is, When it sees $Fred, it says Fred is a name. I will put it in a thing called a symbol table. And when I see $Fred or %Fred later on, I will look up Fred in my symbol table and see what's going on and take appropriate action. So a soft reference is a reference to the symbol table. So it effectively allows you to generate manipulation of the symbol table, so you can get two names referring to the same thing in the symbol table. A hard reference is an actual, so this is so a hard, so it's all like a symbolic reference in the Unix file system. A hard reference is actually a variable, a Perl variable holding an address, which then goes to a symbol table. So a hard reference is what you'd normally think of as a pointer in a language. A soft reference is effectively a way of renaming particular variables, whether they be arrays, scalars, or hashes. So this file here is pretty confusing, because I think soft references are rather confusing, because you do have to think what they mean. So you'll all be pleased to know that if you write star var with the star in front of a Perl name var, that is entirely equivalent to accessing the symbol table. The symbol table is an associative array which is labeled by the name of the Perl variable, and in module form it's associated with the main routine, well, the package, so it's got up here the so the package for the main routine is called main, so there's a symbol table called percent main colon colon, and so that's why star var is entirely equivalent to the variable dollar main colon colon var in quotes. So that is meant to explain, and I guess I get confused every time I read this, that if you write star var equals star original, that means var and original are essentially equivalent as far as names are concerned, because they just reference the same location in the symbol table. And so this has a feature, because we're referencing the symbol table, then we write star var equals star original, it means that not only is dollar var equivalent to dollar original, but percent var is equivalent to percent original, because we're just mapping names. And that's, of course, not entirely trivial, because I explained in the gory detail that dollar var and percent var had no connection with each other as variables. So this particular syntax has pervasive implications, because it doesn't just rename the scalar variable, it renames all variables associated with the string var. So that's why it is clearly different from a hard reference, which would only, these hard references which we'll come to, only address one of the, I mean, they address each of those separately. So here's some quite useful stuff if you want to be confusing. Alright. So supposing I put dollar name equals foo, because we know that all decent computer science things should be called foo. Then if I write dollar, open curly brackets, dollar name, close curly brackets, anything in curly brackets is an expression to be evaluated. We evaluate dollar name and call it foo. We put the dollar in front of it, and so that claims that dollar, open curly brackets, dollar name, close curly brackets equals 6, sets dollar foo equal to 6. So that's sort of that is effectively using this as a reference into the symbol table. So in order to be entirely confusing, we write that as dollar name equals 6, which sets dollar foo equals 6. Now here we have this so-called dereferencing operator, dash greater than dollar name dash greater than 0, sets the array entry dollar foo of 0 equal to 4. And just to show how powerful we are, if we use the multiplication sign of characters, dollar, dollar name, cross 2 equals 6, sets dollar foo foo equals 6, because cross just replicates the character string. So here's the at sign. Is that the at? I never can remember these, but at dollar name equals parentheses. So that sets the array at foo to be the null list. So if I want, I can now do the same thing with subroutines and sign dollar name of arguments, just calls the subroutine foo with arguments. And so this has always been allowed in Perl, although it may not have been documented. And if you don't like it, if you say use strict, it will not allow you to do this. Strict refs. And we'll ignore the last comment. So those things are called type blobs, or symbolic references. So hard references, so effectively they're just, let's say, relabeling, they're just relabeling names. So hard references are actually got a similar syntax to soft references, namely you have this $$ notation. So if I set $scalar ref to be backslash operator dollar foo, which is a different syntax from C or C++. So this backslash operator takes the address of, or form a pointer to. So that says that that thing is a pointer to a scalar. And if we have a pointer to a scalar, we just dereference it by putting the right number, the dollars, in front of it. So dollar get it equals dollar dollar scalar ref, that's dollar get it equals a dollar foo with that particular definition of dollar scalar ref, and so on. And you can do the same thing with arrays and hashes, and it does what you'd expect. So although I, my belief is it is impossible to use this unless you use a lot of it, because it's extremely, in my opinion, extremely confusing. And I remember Wojtek and I struggled for a long time to get this to work for a particular example, to get the exact, we got it to work, and we had the right number of, because we had to get the curly brackets right, and the backslashes, and the right number of dollars, And it does work, but I would view it as a non-obvious. I mean, Larry, well, if you read this book, it is very. You would think it's a wonderful syntax. I consider it not a wonderful syntax, I'm afraid. So I think most things in Perl are pretty good. I think what happened here is the poor old Larry Wall wanted to make Perl 5 consistent with Perl 4, and so he screwed, in my opinion, that was a major error, because what he ended up doing was producing a syntax which is confusing. And you have to understand very clearly what the interpreter is doing to work out what this syntax means. But that does mean if you do nothing else but write Perl all day, I suspect you can write incredibly powerful code extremely fast with this syntax, because this syntax is undoubtedly powerful. Alright. So, one remark about curly brackets, or as Larry Wall likes to call them, curlies. So, if you have curlies, can always be used to disambiguate things, because sometimes it's not entirely clear which way, where, how to, what's the reference, and what's, you know, if you have a complicated thing, it's not entirely clear what the reference is. So curly brackets, because curly brackets always enclose expressions, you can, if you put something in a curly bracket, you know that's evaluated first, because that's so. So I believe that when you get the wrong answer, it's probably because you should probably think about you adding some curly brackets to make it clear to Perl which order it evaluates things. So it's not round brackets, it's curly brackets, because these are expressions, and so you must use the expression disambiguator. So that's why I say $$scalarref, as I defined, is equivalent to dollar curlies with dollar scalar ref inside the curly brackets, which is actually a slightly clearer notation. So here's an example of this confusion. So if I have $$ hash ref of a key, that is equivalent to dollar with the curlies enclosing the hash ref. So it says, look at dollar hash ref, convert it into a reference, I mean, dereference it, and then look up this particular attribute. So that says that dollar hash ref is a pointer to a hash. If this curly bracket was here after this key, it would say dollar hash ref of key is a pointer to a scalar. And that's a very different type of syntax. So whenever you have more than one thing after this dollar, then in principle, you need to have curly brackets to disambiguate it. Of course, Perl has a definite precedent syntax, which if you use it enough, you'll remember. I don't think anybody anybody in MPAC uses it enough to remember it. So here are these so-called anonymous data structures and subroutines. Anonymous data structures and anonymous subroutines are used with references. So the most amusing case is this subroutine here. So if you wish to define a secret subroutine, which effectively is done like this, you say $secretSub. So this thing is going to be a pointer to a function or a subroutine equals sub, and then you have whatever the sub is after here, which says support your favorite, what are we called? School. What is it? A division. I don't know what now engineering computer science is. College. It's a college. Sorry. So it says support your favorite college, so this is subroutine, print that out. So if you set this Perl variable equal to a subroutine, that is effectively making it a pointer to that subroutine. So if you just write and $secretSub, it will execute that subroutine. So this means you can now have Perl variables holding subroutines, which of course is useful, because you might have an if statement saying, if you're a certain member of the faculty of ECS, saying, you could say down with ECS, you could write a different subroutine. So you can change your subroutine which this particular variable points to, which could be in some cases valuable. So this allows you to effectively enclose arbitrary subroutines. So this effectively allows you a pointer to a subroutine. All right. So this is more important. The most important use of these pointers is in multidimensional arrays, and the big advantage of multidimensional arrays is that they're actually relatively understandable, because usually you don't have to use the fact that they're pointers. So as in Java, JavaScript, and most languages, multidimensional arrays are stored as arrays a two-dimensional array is an array of pointers to one-dimensional arrays. Now, three-dimensional arrays are arrays of pointers to one-dimensional arrays. So there is only really one thing to find, a one-dimensional array, or multidimensional arrays are done with pointers. However, the syntax is very elegant and simple if you access the array, because if you have a three-dimensional array, it's defined as you'd expect. Because if you have a three-dimensional array, and you give it three indices, then undoubtedly that thing is a scalar, and so it has $1 here, the name of the three-dimensional array, the right number of indices, and that's it. So multidimensional arrays, if they have the same, if you reference them as elements, are very simple and easy to use, because they have the following extremely useful features. You can have any number of indices. The indices can either be square brackets or curly brackets, so they can be associative or list or standard type arrays. And they can be ragged. Namely, there's absolutely no reason why there's any correspondence in the number of entries for one index and the number of entries for another index. So whereas, of course, in classic languages like Fortran, you're not allowed ragged arrays. Of course, the disadvantage of ragged arrays is that you need to do everything with pointers, which means it's much less efficient than the type of square arrays that Fortran has. But as Paul is an interpreter anyway, everything's extremely inefficient anyway, so it doesn't matter. So Paul better have ragged arrays. Only when you have very fast, high-performance languages like Fortran or Java with simple types do you want to have non-ragged arrays. As I've already mentioned, with one-dimensional arrays, if you access a missing element, you just get undef as the answer. So nothing, you don't abort, you just say the answer's undefined. And you can test on undef with the function called defined. So if you go to the Perl manual, there are a couple of descriptions of these arrays, and this Camel book copied essentially has the same descriptions reproduced. So it has reasonably good descriptions of these arrays. So let's consider this three-index array, which is called, which has two square brackets followed by a curly, and here we have a curly followed by two square brackets. So this thing here should be thought of as fundamentally a hash, because what you should look at is the last variable. If you like, Perl is like Fortran. The last variable is the one that is the most rapidly varying and is sort of the fundamental variable. So this says it's really a hash, but I have two indices which label that hash. So I just have a whole bunch of hashes labeled by two indices. If I have the curly as the first variable, then effectively this thing here should be thought of as having curly brackets around it. So this is a hash. Each hash value is a two-dimensional array. So this is a hash of two-dimensional arrays. This is a two-dimensional hash. And it's relatively obvious that both of those constructs are useful. All the confusion occurs when, if you like, you want to do what Fortran 90 does, then you wish to access these variables with less than the number, with the number of indices which is less than the natural number, because then you're thinking of as a data structure. So that's when you have to worry about what a pointer is. If you access it always with the right number of indices, then Perl 5 looks exactly like Perl 4. So if you take a Perl 4 routine and just substitute hash by hash, let's do this. Supposing I had a Perl 4 routine which had a single hash labeled by curly bracket dollar or something, I can go through and add a couple of square brackets in front of all of I could add this to in front of, between the name of the hash and the attribute, and the routine would work unchanged. So it's extremely easy to use multidimensional arrays. So I think I will skip. I will not mention any of this nonsense about skip the rest, this next stuff, and we will go to foil 40. So those foils I missed tell you about two things which are very peculiar. How to deal with pointers if you wish to refer to these things with fewer numbers of indices than the natural number, and also about the object-oriented structure in Perl. And my intuition is that those are not terribly important, because I do not believe they're done well enough to be worth learning. But there may be a few examples where you wish to use references, then I suggest you read the manuals and get it to work, or you ask Wojtek how to get it right, or maybe I can now do it, but not trivial. And actually, this foil is wrong. It should say capital E for English here. So you should, in general, use English in your Perl program, because this allows you, we taught you that dollar underbar is the argument of a subroutine. If you don't like dollar underbar and you write and you have use English at the beginning of your Perl program, you can write dollar arg instead. So English allows you to use more obvious, less cryptic names than these one character names that you're familiar with. So, and we've already mentioned the dollar max, so I'll skip over that. So there's some functions which are occasionally useful, which you can now use. Like QQ is a function that's equivalent to including the string in double quotes. So QQ does variable interpolation on the string. And so why is that useful? It's because if the string had a quote in it, then you can't enclose it in quotes without putting a backslash in front of any quote inside the string. However, QQ doesn't have to do that. So if you write QQ of string, it interpolates that string, and you do not have to worry about special characters in the string. And the reason this function is called QQ, because it is double quotes. The function Q is equivalent to a single quote. And QX is equivalent to the back quotes, and of course it's called QX because X stands for execute. So this is the quoted execute is equivalent. So instead of saying date in the back quotes, I can just say QX of date. So these are obviously very valuable features which are dying to use. Quote meta is something useful if you forget what the special characters are in the regular expression. Quote meta takes any character in a string, all characters in a string, and if they're special characters or meta characters for regular expressions, it escapes them so that they can be used, so that you can freely use this in a regular expression. So what we'll just quickly mention at the end here. So there are these additional constructs for regular expressions. And these additional constructs have a general syntax. They're in parentheses. They start with a query, and then they have a special character. So parentheses, query, hash sign, anything you like followed by a parenthesis is a comment. So, so this allows you to put comments in a regular expression. So Slash X is a new modifier which allows you to say white space should be interpreted as just being put in there for readability and not part of the regular expression. So these are all tweakings of the regular expressions. Let me skip that. So this is more, I already mentioned this briefly, this is pretty useful. So we're using this query sign quite often. So you query denotes minimum size. So I already mentioned pattern matching is typically greedy. So instead of star query means a minimal match. Plus query means match once in a minimal fashion. Query means match 0 or 1 times in a minimal fashion, and so on. So those are for these meta characters which require any number, 1, 0, 1, or a particular number of times. If you follow that by a query, that says the match is the smallest possible match. So that's very useful, as I mentioned. If you want to find the first occurrence of something, then you typically want a minimal match, whereas previously Perl always did maximal size matches. As you notice, of course, this is hardly the most, you have to just remember this notation. This is not a notation that springs to mind as the obvious notation, but that's life. There's nothing much I can do about it. Alright, so this is this long-rumored way of specifying a grouping, which is just a grouping for disambiguation as opposed to a grouping to generate a reference. So I pointed out if you take a part of a regular expression and close it in round brackets, it generates one of these $1 or $1 references, which are very useful. But then we also mentioned that you might want to use round brackets to disambiguate things like choices of characters. So Perl 5, some electrical engineers should be able to cure that feature. Perl 5 has this ingenious notation, parentheses, query, colon. So parentheses, query, colon, close parentheses, means a simple grouping which does not generate one of these $1, $2, $3 references. So the problem with that notation is, again, you have to remember it. It's not hardly, again, springs to mind as the obvious notation. There are also, so in again, the spirit of new syntax with the query operator, parentheses query equal represents something which is included in the match as a requirement for the match, but is not considered part of the matching string. So if you want to find a particular match followed by something else, so the thing you want is the thing in front. So let's give an example. We want to match a tag, so we go up to the greater than sign, then we don't care about the greater than sign, we want the stuff before the greater than sign or before the quote. We could use this notation because then we would make certain that the match variable returns the first part of the regular expression, not the second part. And then query exclamation mark is the same idea, except it matches to the regular expression which is not followed by the following stuff. So we've already done this. So that's, well, let me just finish. Maybe this is a good place to finish. So these are very useful functions, which I've again mentioned quite often before, but they're defined properly here. The function defined, when you give it an expression, it will just tell you whether that the expression is undef or not. So obviously that can be used when you're testing these ragged arrays to see if a particular array entry exists or various other things. So it obviously returns true if the expression is defined, which means it's not equal to undef. There is another useful command called undef. So that's a function which undefines something. So this is pretty useful if you have a subroutine which deals with a has a variable, and it sets the variable if something is some. Especially this is useful for hashes, where you might have various keys which are sometimes set and sometimes not set. When you begin a loop, you might want to just say undef of that hash, and that completely undefines it. And so if it happened to be defined beforehand from in the previous loop, it's now undefined. So undef is a way of clearing an entire, if you view a hash as a container of information, you just clear that container. So if you're looping over, say that example I had with processing mail entries, so you're looping over that mail those mail entries, and you have several of them, this just cleans out the old values of the hash and makes certain that you have no history. So undef is pretty useful. And it can be very flexible. You can undef a scalar, an array, or a hash, and you can undef a particular entry in a hash. So you can have some things preserved and some things not. Exist is slightly different from undef, because if you think about a hash, there are two things that can be wrong with. If you access the key of a hash, two things could happen. One thing is the key could not exist because you haven't set it. The other thing is the key could exist because you try to set the value, but that value was undefined. So if you use exists of a hash, then that returns true if you've defined that key, if you've used that key, whether or not the value is defined or undefined. If you say defined of a hash, it will return true if the key is both the key exists and the value is defined. So exist and define are slightly different. Okay. All right. So that's all we're going to do in Perl. And I still view it as a pretty useful language. My belief is that because Perl 5 has, in my opinion, serious flaws as a language, which makes it far inferior to Java, because I don't think it's logically constructed in the way Java is. I fear that Perl will not grow in the same fashion that Java will. So eventually, maybe Perl will get replaced by Java, but currently it's clearly superior to, and in fact the only way of doing things, basically batch text processing and system calls on Unix and Windows systems. So I believe it's an incredibly valuable language to have, and I would personally steer clear of these high-end features of Perl, because I don't think they'll survive. And we'll do VRML on Monday. Thank you.